here today with Drew Kirst, who is the single owner of Fark.com. And one of Drew's most interesting things is the volume of traffic. So maybe, Drew, you want to tell us a little bit about the site and who you are for those who haven't heard from you before?
Yeah, well, essentially, they finally came up with a name for it. They're calling it a news aggregator now, and I guess that's about as close as we have been before. It's a trend that going into the social networking circle as well, but I keep telling people that we're Web 3.0, which is good editing. Take your user submissions, but then so they actually go through that now, because not everything everybody sends in is worth actually reading.
Yeah, you've been called a blob for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, we really weren't. I was more happy to let people continue to call it that, but we're not really blob.
And then a news aggregator sounds like a more realistic term. What's interesting about what you're doing is that you ran it pretty much by yourself, and then you want to talk about your traffic volume.
Yeah, we're up to 52 or 53 million page views in the last 30 days, which is 25% higher than last year. Uniques in the audience are about 3.75 million.
And so this is traffic then that you drive from your house in, you live in Kentucky, don't you?
Yep, that's right.
And so you just drive out of your house, and it's mainly driven by public relations, is that right?
Yeah, pretty much. Another interesting stat traffic-wise that most people don't consider, because it isn't really an issue for most places, is that we're also sending out about 50 million page views a month. That we don't get. Those aren't accredited, but they don't. They land on other sites, mostly mainstream media sites.
Right, okay. So you get 53 million page views a month, so that's 3.5 million uniques, right? And so you got this started by, actually, why don't you talk a little bit about how you got started, how the traffic volume has grown, and how you keep it going, because the whole radio thing is a little unusual in that model, as I'm sure you know.
Yeah, definitely. It started out, I was spending most of my mornings just around reading funny news stories and finding the occasional one emailing it to a friend of mine. And after a while, I started to suspect he might be getting annoyed by all this email I was sending out, so I decided, okay, the heck with this, then I'll go ahead and put this up on my website, and I told him if you guys are still interested, you are more than welcome to continue reading on the website, and that's really how it started. The way that it grew, though, over time was through a combination of publicity and just not sucking. I always tell people, you can't really lose your audience without actually pissing them off. And the way we gained it over time was I'm doing the occasional radio interview to start a spot weekly on Tech TV for about a year and a half. And none of those things actually generated a lot of traffic by themselves, but it was the continuing reputation over time that made all the difference.
So you were on Tech TV, so you were a regular person that you got interviewed, or you did interviewed, and then say that you ran in front of people over a period of time?
Yeah, they would have me on every Friday, and I would go down the three weirdest, usually tech-oriented stories of the week, but I think we started drifting after a while, because usually the weirdest stories of the week weren't usually tech-related. It was one of those things, too, where I don't know what Tech TV's ratings were. I do talk to a lot of people that saw me on there. In fact, I was down in Memphis this weekend and talked to somebody who had seen me on there back in the day. So I don't know that, like I said, I don't remember even seeing any traffic spike from those guys online after doing it. But what I did notice was that in a week when I did Tech TV, and this is back when the traffic was much lower, in a week when I did the show, our traffic would rise slightly. Not a lot, just a little bit. In a week when I didn't do the show, it would remain flat. So it was obvious over time that we were definitely gaining viewers from it. It just wasn't clear how many. But I think that, again, it was the consistency. It was doing it nonstop. People don't generally check out websites the first time they hear about it, which is, you'll see the, the cable billboards or spot ads or whatever. People will go check them out about the 20th or 30th time they see it.
So what you're talking about here is almost like a success of branding. Like, you've actually branded your way into building all this traffic.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, our traffic stats show that as well. Very little of our traffic is actually coming from search. I think it's something like less than 1.5% of our traffic is coming from Google. And about 65% of it is coming, people are just typing the name in or have the bookmark and they're coming straight there.
So does this mean your site ongoing is dependent on doing interviews? I mean, if you stop, will your traffic just slowly decline?
I don't know. I doubt it. I think it just won't go up anymore. It'll stop, basically. It'll stop dead, and that'll be the end of it. But, into that, so, like I said, always word of mouth, too, but we noticed that, in order to lose readers, you have to actively irritate them. So unless you do that, as long as you keep the quality up, you're not likely to lose them. You probably still get the word of mouth. It just happens to work out.
And so, you mentioned, you get an increase in traffic when you were running. Like, are you able to quantify that at all, or you just see a bump? I mean, are you talking, a 5% bump, or 10%? Is it 100,000 visitors?
Well, back when we were doing Tech TV initially, we didn't have that much traffic. But right now, we've had situations where I get mentioned in Time Magazine. I've been in two or three times. I can't tell any appreciable difference in traffic. I'm sure it's probably generating something like 10,000 page views, but our daily number rotates from somewhere between 1.8 and 1.9 million, up to as high as maybe 2 to 2.1. And so if you get an extra 10,000 from something, it's probably worth the watch. But that's just today. For example, I was sitting around doing a radio interview up in Indiana where the guy had never heard of Fark before, but he was talking about how big the show I was on. It's Bob and Tom's was 125, 150 affiliate market. And he said, if you go check your website later today, you're going to see 2 or 3,000 hits. I didn't tell him that I wasn't going to be able to see that because of the traffic we already have, but at the same time, that's still a significant amount of traffic for somebody who doesn't have any.
And so at what point did you realize that this was actually working to drive traffic to your website? Because that obviously wasn't the strategy in the beginning, or was it?
No, it wasn't actually. The real thing was it was to try to just get practice because I was hoping at some point to, you know, be the regular person that could do stuff like that and go on, you know, shows and whatnot and do that. So that was the original purpose of it. What ended up happening was I accidentally ended up doing a classic branding approach without knowing what I was doing.
And so how long after you started doing that did you realize, well, hey, this is actually working and I need to keep doing it?
It was actually quite a while after that, actually. I think I'd done tech TV for a year before we noticed. And so it was one of those things where, but it seems to be the case. It's unconventional. Listen, for example, if you can get a 5-minute spot on TNN at any given time, for example, it's going to work out a lot better for you than any kind of advertising you could possibly do. Because people generally ignore advertising, but they don't ignore news.
Right. And I guess in your case, you hadn't promoted the site anywhere else, had you? So it was kind of a no-brainer as to where all the traffic was coming from.
Yeah, because at that point, they were the only guys that were having me on. It was one of those deals where, even back then, most North American radio stations were using Fart as a morning show resource, but absolutely nobody was giving it credit. Now we get a decent amount of credit, but it still could be better.
Hmm. Okay. It's interesting. I mean, have you heard of anyone else doing this in the way that you are?
No. I think other than, like, if you're classic publicist approach, if you have, like, a C-list celebrity client, you'd probably be trying to do this stuff, and they're different methods than one that they understand. Like I said, it was one of the things where I just kind of accidentally backed into it. It wasn't really intending to do this, but it ended up working out, and then when I turned around and looked back and saw the path, I was like, okay, well, this is obvious.
Yeah, right. So if there's someone that's got a site that they're making sales and they're doing, you know, internet-type stuff, how would you recommend they do what you're doing? It's something that adds value, I mean, even if they can't initially see results?
Yeah, like it is over time. Again, it's like one of those things where because one parent isn't going to do it, you need to have 20 or 30. So, for example, you see on local TV, you'll have people that, you know, join a doctors will do a, you know, a doctor segment where they'll have some specialist come in from a local, you know, municipality to talk about, you know, whatever anybody's questions may happen to be. And in reality, this is really just an ad for that person's practice. To take it a step further, there are certain tricks of the trade you can do in order to get newspapers, magazines, and TV to pick up stories about products. But the trick is that they won't take a straight ad, and the extreme won't take it if it's not exceptionally different from anything anybody else is doing. So in order to get any kind of publicity, you have to throw a curveball.
Right. Fair enough. I'm looking at your Alexa rank. I notice your Alexa rank today is like 2,157.
And yeah, it's been going down pretty steadily for the last year and a half, which is bizarre considering our traffic keeps going up.
Yeah, that's what I want to ask you about, because when we first talked to you like a year and a half ago, so your Alexa rank was like 800 or something. And so it's been going down. Back then you were getting about 1 million page views a day. You said it was only between a million to 2 million, and now you're really touching on the 2 million a day as an average.
Yeah, it's kind of up. I don't really understand how Alexa works exactly. Like, to give an example, I was saying Michael Arrington over at TechCrunch was saying that hits like 6 million page views a month, and their Alexa ranking is something like 300 or something, and I had absolutely no explanation for it about Apple's name. I mean, Alexa is not a scientific tool, and you're right after it. It's just kind of odd that it's that different, though. It doesn't make any sense.
No, in that case, that makes sense to me, because what his readership of people are more likely to have the toolbar and soul.
Yeah, well, so our readership is a lot more mainstream. I mean, they're still fairly intelligent, but they're a lot more mainstream and not as academic.
Yeah, which makes sense, but what's surprising is that yours has dropped so much. I thought they were kind of working this stuff out. But, yeah, I mean, you've got your stats. I remember you even showed me your stats, and you would, about that time, you definitely earned 1 to 2 million a day.
Yeah, and what was weird about it is I don't really know how they're tracking this, but, like, one of the reasons we've seen explosive growth in the social networking sector really isn't because, and this is a mistake that a lot of people make when they read about it, isn't because it's a good idea, necessarily. It's because it generates a phenomenal amount of page views. That at the, and when you take away everything else, at the end of the day, that's what really is driving the interest in this, and because you're selling, you know, ads based on the 1,000-page model, that is of extreme interest. It's one of those deals where, for example, people will make the mistake of thinking that just because somebody's extremely wealthy, they must be intelligent. It's not necessarily the case. So you'll see things, for example, like on Facebook, which they just changed this recently, where, for example, if somebody wants to friend you and you click on it to say, okay, authorize that, it takes you to another page, which is where you meet this person. Well, you don't need to have another page in there, but by adding that extra page, that's another page view, and I can only assume that they kicked your Alexa rank up. So, for example, like on the social networking site, say like this, where you vote on articles, our average person shows up on Fart and reads about 2 pages. The average person shows up on Facebook and will go through about 100 of them. It's still the same user, and it's all the same, but they've also been noticing that the quality of the page views on social networking site, it's pretty bad. I was talking to Starcom out in L.A. when we were talking to about the advertising advertising and whatever, that didn't mean a few other folks. They were saying that the value of page views on Facebook and MySpace was pretty bad because people tend to just kind of rip through there while they're doing stuff. They're having friends. They're just, you know, moving around. And it's interesting that even Comscore has recently made a significant change in the way they rank sites. Now they're looking at doing it based on time per page, not number of page views. And the minute that change went through, all of a sudden Facebook went from having a separate page for where you know this person, to all of a sudden it's dropped down bucks. No?
It came through that quickly.
Yeah, and it's interesting, too, because, like, you'll see these little, like, the way that these sites are designed. Like, for example, anytime you see, like, a top 10, top 50 list or whatever on a news site, you'll see, especially when it involves pictures, and especially when it involves pictures of hot chicks, they will put one per page, no thumbnail advanced. So, basically, if you wanted to go see who got number one, you have to go all the way through all 50 of them in order to generate all that traffic.
You know,
we don't do any of that stuff, so it's probably driving us downward.
You know, and like just in a related point, I was looking, I hardly read magazines anymore, and I was just looking at one magazine, I forget what it was, I was in the airport, just looking through some magazines, and just noticing that to get to the table of contents, and I just hadn't seen this for ages, but that to get to the table of contents, I had to flick through like 6 pages of ads, and it wasn't even clear where it was, it was kind of like it was buried. And I was like, in advertising where there's popovers and all this other stuff to try and increase ad impressions.
Yeah, that's actually a value add when you go and sell to your brand advertisers. That's what you say. You say, where that spot right in front of the table of contents is worth more money because you're going to be poking around trying to talk to the damn thing, and you're going to be going past their ads in the process. They actually charge more money for that positioning, and that's why there's so many ads right there.
Yeah, right. So it's the same business model, just in different media, and this is how they adapted it to the internet.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I mean, these things have been around for a while. It's no big deal whatsoever. My only problem is that I keep asking, having people ask me, why is our traffic going down based on the lack of those numbers, and it's just kind of annoying me because our traffic is actually up 25%.
Yeah, so what do you, have you looked at something that's more accurate than Alexa, Compete, or, I mean, have you found something there?
For us, no. We're kind of behind the eight ball on this, because our pattern comes from two main sources. It's people who are reading at work, and people who are reading at colleges. The problem is that a lot of this stuff that is more accurate, requires the individual to install this stuff on a browser, and that's why sites that track via, install stuff like the way Alexa works, probably rank far a lot lower than they should, because they don't see people coming in from work. Most people work in work environments where their computers are locked down, they don't have the option to install this stuff, which is good. But you lose all of those people for terms of metrics. The other thing which is really interesting is that Quadcast is one that we've been using. You can install code on your page. And have it on. And just the same way you can do with Google Analytics, but Quadcast allows you to actually link to it and show people what the traffic is. And it's interesting the difference between Quadcast and Google Analytics, because Quadcast and Google are both saying that we're getting the same number of pages, but Quadcast is undercounting the uniques by 1.5 million, or Google is overcounting it. And they're basically looking at the same information and making different determinations about what's going on.
What are you talking about? Google Analytics, and what was the other one?
Quantcast is Quantcast. It's basically like Alexa, but what they do is if you aren't using their code, they just gather what your site traffic is. We hooked up to it because it was so far off, it was ridiculous, so we went ahead and plugged their code in their page, and they got page views. Right? They go like Google, but the uniques are about 1.5 million different for whatever reason.
So I can look. Okay, let me.
But the interesting about Quantcast is that I've been looking at it, and I've been told that that's fairly easy. A lot of server farms will come from Asia and whatnot in order to like drive people like rankings up. And you can kind of tell this is going on if you look at the percentage, especially for U.S. sites, percentage of traffic from the United States, for example, I think big is something like on the order of 23%. Or something like that. I don't know, that's having.com, for example. Now, 23% of the U.S., it's interesting to point out that as far as advertisers are concerned, those are the only pages that are worth anything. They don't give a rat's ass about the other 77% that are coming to a site. They won't even expect every advertising contract you get will require you to geo-target down to the United States only, because they don't want to go outside of it.
So this is fascinating. So Quantcast, then, you've put their tracking code on your site. I'm looking at quantcast.com/FARC.com. Yep. And so they've been going in, and like, I mean, you opened up your Google Analytics a long time ago. They've actually opened these stats up to all users so that users can see from a third-party independent metric on how stats actually break down.
Yes, exactly. And so it works exactly the same way. Like I said, it's interesting that the page views are reported identically, but the uniques are counted separately. I mean, obviously, it just means that they're looking at the same information, but they make different determinations about what constitutes a unique hit.
And so what do you see that their stats are accurate, or are there inaccuracies in it?
The pictures are, but what I'm also seeing is I'm seeing the same thing happening with Quantcast that's happening with Alexa, which is as more people discover it, the rank that we had, like, we started out around 500 on that thing, we're being driven down now again. Like, I think we're closing in on stop and dropping. And there are a few sites out there that I know are completely faking all of their traffic that are getting ranked up in the upper, like, you know, 2 digits. So it's not foolproof by any stretch, but it's just one of those things, you know, that you can look at to get kind of a better idea what's going on. In general, these things only provide a relative guess at how you're doing. They're not very accurate at all.
Yeah, I mean, saying you're 2,157. What do you think your real Alexa would be?
I have no idea. That's a good question. The problem is that I don't know how to rank it. I mean, if it's just straight up page views, that's one thing, but there's an argument that could be made that straight up page views isn't worth anything. When your site is being valued, they actually look at the uniques. In particular, when advertisers, mainstream advertisers are looking at you, they aren't looking at buying page views as much as they want to know how big is your audience. They don't really care about the number of pages you got.
All right, interesting stuff. All right, let's move on. Monetization is an interesting part of your site. You've started handling this differently. You had to deal with Federated Media. You have people helping you with your revenue inventory. Do you want to talk a little bit about how you do it and sort of where you're going with that?
Yeah, Federated Media is basically a group of folks that they kind of basically, you outsource your sales basically to them. And they do a pretty good job, actually. We've kind of moved away from them in recent years to something called Channel Conflict. We were approached by Maxim magazine, which used to be Dennis Digital Group, and now they're calling themselves Alpha Media. And it's basically Maxim under itself. And we were approached by them. They basically said, look, how about we'll do the same thing for you, but we'll only do you. We're not going to start a network. We're not going to go on anybody else but you and the three of us, and then that's it. So that was a much more attractive deal, mainly because the drawback with Federated Media was is that, you know, they have a number of other clients. I think they have something like 150 member sites that they're paying attention to, and salespeople aren't the most attentive people in the world, so getting attention over there is difficult. Whereas if you're the sole client, essentially, like we are with Maxim, it's a much better deal. And basically what they do is they try to get the brand advertising, which is only pay per 1,000 impressions, no pay per click, no pay per performance, it's straight up paid use.
And so what kind of clients did Federated Media bring in and then now Maxim?
Federated Media did pretty good. I'm trying to think. They had a few A-listers. I mean, it was like it was good stuff. Fortune 500 companies for the most part. Maxim does a bit of a better job on it, mostly because Federated Media is located out of Silicon Valley. Most of their authors are tech-oriented. And since they're in Silicon Valley already, obviously they've got better reach into tech companies, and so they end up spending a lot more time working on those. Maxim is targeting more of the male type audience, the automotive, your beer, your, you know, anything that guys might consume. Of course, that's a much better fit for us than the tech audiences. So, for example, we've had some pretty good deals up there. I think we had, a couple of vodka ones recently, Kawasaki took on that, Old Spice. You know, stuff that people have actually heard of before. To me, that was extremely important because the quality of ads on your site actually impacts how people perceive the quality of your overall site is, which is really bizarre. For example, if you go look at the Drudge Report, it'd be like if you see anything other than mortgage ads. That doesn't, like, you know, give you a real good impression of the site, but if you saw, say, you know, Burger King up there all the time, you'd think, wow, this guy's probably doing pretty good.
Yeah, right. And what kind of CPM rates do you get for advertising on your site?
You know, I don't know. Maxim's handling that, and I haven't got any idea. In general, what they do is, this mystifies me because I'm not a salesperson, so it doesn't make any sense to me, but basically they go to a meeting. They just basically have these ephemeral arguments, which is kind of akin to, you know, having arguments about, you know, the whole meaning of life thing, because their arguments are based on nothing other than trying to convince the other guy that they should be paying X amount of money. So it's really kind of bizarre to me, but it's one of these things that is a mechanism that's been in place now for 150 years and not going away anytime soon, so that's just how it works.
And so have the check gotten bigger since you've been working with Maxim there and me?
Yeah, it's finally starting to get there. I mean, it's not like as far as, like, you know, our level of where we could get to, we're still a long ways from that. But as far as, like, you know, from the beginning, it took about a year. It actually took closer to, like, 15 months before we started getting any kind of traction at all on the advertising because of the way that these branded advertisers work. And it's kind of simple if you think about it. It can be summed up in an old saying you hear in tech circles all the time, which is nobody ever got fired for buying Microsoft, which comes from an older saying, which was nobody ever got fired for buying IBM. And I'm sure it goes back farther than that. But the upshot of it is if you're a media buyer and you have clients, which are basically companies, because the companies themselves don't do the advertising, they subbed out. So you have these clients, they'll basically want to know, where did you place their ad? And you can safely say, New York Times, Washington Post, and they're not going to sign an eye. But if you say Park, and they haven't heard of it, or worse, they're not happy about that, and you're in trouble. So what they tend to do more often than not is they'll take a very large advertising budget, dump it all on one very sick mainstream site, and then be done with it. So the challenge of working with Maxim for the first 15 months was convincing them it was a good idea. Convincing these advertisers that they're not going to be screwed, that it will work, it'll perform, nobody's going to hire them, most importantly. And basically building the brand up so that when they think Maxim, they think Fark also being on par. And after that happens, then you start getting a little traction where first they try to do some sample buys, they do a little bit of goofing around, they'll pass the waters a bit first before they start, you know, putting larger and larger quantities of money. And so far we're just kind of at that sampling stage right now, but it's encouraging because it's just definitely picking up.
How do those guys decide, like, what is a sample that actually works and what doesn't?
As far as I can tell, it's clearly arbitrary. I really can't tell because the salespeople are testing, trying to get a sample size up because I get the money. I really don't see any standard level of that across the board. I mean, I've seen as few as 5,000 pages and as many as 100,000. I mean, it just doesn't seem to make any difference one way or the other. It's bizarre.
Because, I mean, a lot of this, as I understand, your site generates a lot of volume, but the advertising on it doesn't generate very high click-throughs, right?
Well, it depends. We have simultaneously with the records for the best and worst click-through rates ever. And it just really depends on the advertising. Some of the advertising does amazingly well, and some of it bombs amazingly badly. And so it's really bizarre. Basically, whenever they rank a performance, because, you know, they're selling these ads on back and letter and stuff also, we're either the number one or the number four as far as the click-through for impression.
Do you care? Like, let's say you get an ad that comes on that takes, does really well with click-throughs. Do you care, given that that's taking away click-throughs from the rest of the site?
Well, it depends, not really, because when you get to the level of advertisers that we're dealing with, they're more concerned with branding. They want to make sure that people see it, and they're just using click-through as a way to gauge the effectiveness of the advertisement. They're not really concerned so much with how many people actually go. For example, one of the things that we've been doing is packaging sponsored links with advertising. It's basically a value ad. We don't charge for it. We have to label it sponsored, but we don't charge money for it. We just basically say, if you take that ad, we'll throw one of these in. And we've noticed that a sponsored link will send anywhere between 6 to 25 to, I think our record's 50,000 clicks to a particular target site. And the advertisers we're dealing with just don't care how many people go to. They're happy about it, don't get me wrong, but they really aren't totally concerned with it, as much as they're concerned about the fact that that link will be up on Bar's main page for 36 hours and that's not 3 million pages.
Yeah, right. So do you, that, I mean, when they're doing these test buys, it doesn't really mean anything, does it?
No, not at all. In fact, it'll come and go. We had test buys where I'd never even seen the ad go by.
Because it went up so quickly that you burn through their impressions.
Yeah, if somebody buys 5,000 impressions, even if they all run them the same day, Fark is getting like 2 million. So the odds of me seeing that are, you know, through the math, it's not very high.
And so what they're quantifying a successful campaign on is a little bit of an unknown.
Yeah, basically. I mean, it sounds like it's a combination of something that they're looking for and the effectiveness of the Dell people in convincing them that it actually works. Like I said, again, it's completely bizarre to me because these arguments that I hear them, these sales pages, I should say, that I hear them making are really based on nothing. And this isn't unique to the Maxim Group either. It's basically unique to the entire sales process at that level. It's just kind of fun, but that's why I don't do sales.
And so you have your volume there. And so what phase of your advertising volume is CPM, and what do you fill out with remnant inventory?
We're probably still... I can say about like 80-90% remit at this stage, which I'm going to find out is actually not uncommon, not that at that high, but you rarely will ever sell all your inventory out, so having your remit backup is going to be pretty much a component in the entire time. I think half remit is probably what most people are running on. So I think a lot of traffic have difficulty filling, it's kind of catch-22, it's great that you have all that traffic, but you also have a difficulty filling all your space up. So, you know, having remit guys run it is no big deal, provided it's quality remit, and it is. Like, for example, I've seen Blockbuster run in their remit, and actually Netflix, too, and Netflix was in amusing situations where sometimes the code isn't tracking closely enough, and you have an ad for Blockbuster and Netflix on the same page load at the same time.
And so, how do you feel that? I mean, so you have Maxim running all your brand advertising. Who fills in all your remit inventory?
I forget what we're using. The problem in our case was finding somebody who could actually fill out any impressions, because we have a lot, as far as the industry goes. And the other problem is that you want to make sure you're getting paid on it as well, something reasonable other than, you know, 5 cents or 1,000 or whatever. I forget who it is we're using, but there's one company in particular, I don't even know where they're located, it manages to fill in about, I think we're getting this direct from them, about 10 to 15 million views a month impressions, and then the rest backfilled with Google AdSense, which does horrible in part.
So you're actually, for your remnant inventory, you're filling them up as well?
Yes.
But why would they have issues with quantity, given that that's the CPM base, that CPA base, right?
No, actually, the remnant that we're using is CPM based. There's other remnant out there you can get that's all CPA, but the stuff that we're using is where the CPM-based remnant, they're really rare in the field, basically. You don't see a lot of them around.
And you use them because, what kind of CPM they pay?
I don't know. It fluctuates around. I think the eCPM is something like, I don't know, I gotta be not speculating, it's like 35 to 50 cents or something like that, but I don't know.
And why would you not just go and backfill it with lots of CPA offers?
Because traditionally on FARC, and I don't know how this works on the rest of the internet, traditionally on FARC they perform badly. I don't know if that's a function of our audience or what to deal with, but it generally not worked, so we quit doing them.
So right now you have three stages then. You have your 10 to 20% of brand advertising that's being sold out for you by Maxim, and then you have, I guess, another 70% that's being sold on a CPM basis at about 50 cents through this network, which you're not sure what the name is.
And actually, it is. 70% is like 70% of the breakdown between those guys and Google AdSense, and I don't know what the ratio is of that. It changes month to month.
And in the last part, it's filled in by Google AdSense, and
Yeah, and AdSense really, really fails on FARC. I think it has to do with the fact that, you know, AdSense always tries to read a page and gauge, you know, the content of the page and then deliver ads accordingly, but the stuff we have up on FARC is so bizarre and perverse that it can't figure it out. We just went over to a new AdSense program that Federated Media actually is heading up, and now that we're about 2 months into it, even they're confused. I wonder if this will happen, about how low the revenue is coming off of it. I mean, it's bizarre. Nobody can figure it out, but I think it may be an unsolvable problem.
Right. Why are you filling in with AdSense? Why not get a couple of day networks to fill it in with that rather than AdSense? I mean, the payout should be
high. We're doing a test run. Supposedly they've rated the codes and it's worked better, and so we're trying it for a few months, but, you know, so far no good, and we may be interested in looking at something else long term.
And have you tried any like the behavioral networks like Lithium or Tecode?
No, I haven't tried any of those guys yet. I would suspect we might have the same problem, but again, you know, once this AdSense stuff goes down the tubes, like I expect, we're probably looking again.
So you're actually going to have to drop AdSense?
Well, I'm not happy, but if it's not working, we'd be silly not to.
What kind of CDM do you get on AdSense?
I don't know. It's horrible, though. I mean, it's only like a few $1,000 a month, I know, with the main through. And if you're concerned with millions of pages you're getting, it should be enormously higher. Even Google is concerned about it, by the way. They called me in for a meeting about a year and a half ago down San Francisco to talk about it because they couldn't figure it out.
And so, I mean, what, the AdSense is running at like 5 cents CPM or something, is it?
Or something, yeah. The problem is that the ads that are running on FARC, I think, are either not relevant or not interesting. And since, at the end of the day, AdSense is actually based on a click-through, even though they try to deliver the money based on effective CPM. Effective, the word effective means not CPM, you know, so they're basically, for whatever reason, they don't do well.
And so, do you ever work with individual advertisers? I mean, let's say I've got an ad campaign that I want to run that I think would work, and maybe it even is a little bit too aggressive and you think it'll piss off your users. Would you still take it? Or, like, how do you work with individual advertisers? What are the limits on who you will work with?
What we do right now is we'll work with anybody, but in general now, the way that it's set up, if anybody comes to us individually, the way basically we do hand off to Maxim, I mean, we'll still work in liaison with it, like, because there's a number of advertisers, like Honda, for example, on an advertiser on FARC, but not Active Blender and stuff, for whatever reason. So, you know, we'll still work on that. But in general, there's a lot of, like, I'm probably in favor of less intrusive ads than most websites are. For example, we don't do interstitial, we don't do pop-ups. I don't like floating ads either, the ones that kind of follow you around, but somebody submitted one that was a template for Corona recently that I actually liked. What it was is you got your leaderboard across the top. and you got your 300, like 200 square rectangle ad, kind of down below. And what it would do is it would run a, it ran an ad up at the top saying something like Corona Roger, you know, it's great. In the Sprinter by 250, they have a martini glass or a beer glass or something like that, and visually the hand would come down out of the top ad into the side and grab the lime or the hollow, I forget what the hell it was, out of the glass and then pull it back away again. And I like that because it gets your attention. It doesn't last long enough to stay in the way, and so by virtue of that fact, it's pretty unobtrusive, and I thought that pretty cool.
But that's sort of like a branded advertising. What about, and I mean, you see on the social networks, they had lots of like the smiley campaigns and all that sort of stuff. And I don't know.
Yeah.
One must presume that they're performing at the highest effective CPM. Will you actually, even if it's going to rather take Google AdSense at 5 cents CPM rather than, smileys at 50 cents?
Yeah, well, the problem is they don't make that much money for us on our site. Like, I'm sure they probably come up with those guys. When we run those ads, they just bought them. I mean, in fact, very early on, I forget what ad network it was, but it was a CPA-based ad network that we, I forget, it was one of the big guys that got bought. It was like, wasn't Bell Clinton or Mayuclay, but it's one of them, they're part of them now. Actually threw us off the network because we had record low CPM clicks on that. We were, nobody was checking them out. It was so bad, they actually accused us of not running the ads.
But they were running on a CPA one. They were running on CPM.
They're only on CPA, and they can track it, but they're accusing us of faking the data or something like that after a while because they said, you know, it just could not possibly be as low as it was.
So let's say that I've met you somewhere. Let's say we had a dinner conversation, all kind of stuff, and I've got an offer that I think would work. Let's say it's how to make money playing poker or something like that. How do I get that to you and get you to run that on your site?
We would basically then go ahead and take that up to Maxim for a big ad buy. We have a classified ad though, which is probably a better test of to see whether it'll actually work. Because my general experience has been that those things fail horribly on our site for whatever reason. I don't know if it's because of the readership or why. They tend to be smarter than the average bear, and they tend to recognize this stuff and ignore it immediately. So we have pretty much little or no success back kind of thing.
And I mean, let's say you're saying I take it to Maxim, but Maxim only wants to sell branded advertising, and they've got
right, and that's how they'll charge for it. And basically, what their argument will be is if it actually is going to make that much money on a CPA or CPC basis, then why not rip us off? Pay what you would consider to be a lesser rate. For example, I had a guy. This is an exact example. But I had a guy, for example, that wanted to do a branded credit card with ARC, and he said something like, "Well, I'll split the proceeds with you, and you'll make $30,000 a month." I said, "Well, okay, how about this? How about you just give me five rather than split the proceeds, and you keep the rest, which is essentially the offer that Maxim makes back, and again, refuse to do it." And I always thought that was kind of weird because to me, if there are huge payouts going on CPA and CPC basis, why not rip off the media client and go ahead and take their flat rate and then just keep the lion's share of the money rather than getting half of it away?
So if someone comes to you, and I mean, so you're generally, what you're generally doing when you call them to Maxim then is just saying, sorry, we're not interested in the CPA offer. But Maxim is the one that's saying no, is that right?
Exactly. But if it is a good CPA offer, it's high performing and whatnot, and it doesn't need to be highly targeted, then it would probably be to some of the advantage to switch to a CPM model instead to keep more of the money, because you can do, basically, you convert a percentage payout to a flat rate payout, and you should be able to make money on that, in theory.
Well, it depends on what the CPN is, but the typical offer like that is only going to work at a maximum of something like 50 cents, but that doesn't
Not true,
the CPM rate that you care about, or do
you? Yeah, right. I don't know. That's a good question. That's right on the border of me carrying it out there.
So if I come to you with an offer, and let's say it is a CPA offer, but I really want to get going, what if I come to you and I say, okay, Drew, here's $2,000. Can you give me a shot? Give me $2,000 worth of CPM on your site.
Yep, probably so.
You would consider running something like that?
Yep.
And in that instance, you wouldn't refer me over to Maxim. You would take it yourself?
Well, actually, contractually, we have to, so I would have to send it over to Maxim no matter what, but they don't, you know, reject stuff.
And so if, let's say Maxim then sends me, so then I take my $2,000 and go and give it to Maxim. What kind of CPM rate are they going to give me for that?
I don't know. That's a good question.
Right, okay. So, I mean, it's because they're probably going to be wanting at least a dollar or two, aren't they, or is that not correct?
I would think so, but, yeah, I would be shocked if they would mess with anything less than that.
So essentially, you're really only spending any time on branded advertising, which you still give to Maxim.
Right, because if you think about it, the reason is because while we're not necessarily topping out yet, this is the only way we can top out yet. For example, at some point, like I talked to you, I met the guy who runs the Fix Your Jobs blog recently, and we were talking about just stuff in general. He asked me, he told me what his advertising deal was that Forbes was giving him. He asked me, he thought that he wasn't getting enough money, but it was actually phenomenal. I'm not going to disclose what it was just in case it's some kind of secret. I mean, for all I don't know if he wants me to tell people or not, but it was awesome. Like, how would we get that? And, but it has to do with the fact that you got Forbes who basically is charging, you know, $50 to $75 CPMs because they're a business outfit, and therefore their ads are highly targeted and towards, you know, financial companies which have got large amounts of cash. In this business as a website, the only way you can hit your maximum revenue potential is by going the CPM route, and so at some point you just make the decision to go that way 100%.
But he, for example, he has no random inventory on site.
No, that guy basically got bought by Forbes or something or other, but he's getting revenue based off of CPM stuff, and because Forbes is selling it so high, he's actually making great money for what he's got.
Right. With your inventory, do you switch networks a lot? Do you do different things to monetize as a publisher side when you see that things aren't performing, or you just kind of let it run and not worry about it?
trying to let it run and not worry about it, because at the end of the day, what's really going to make it is Maxim going out and selling high dollar CPMs and, you know, coming close to selling the entire site out. And that's the direction we're moving in, and I don't know if it's going to get there anytime soon or not, but that's where we want to be. So all the rest of this stuff is really just kind of superfluous.
Right.
But see, what you need in that respect, like, I'm definitely not recommending that everybody who has a website go do this, because honestly, most can't. Even high-volume sites can't do it. It's interesting to me, also, to know what I know about this, because, you know, we've been working with a incredibly capable group of people for now a year and a half. And it's 15 months to get the first amount of traction, and I think that is interesting ramifications down the road for a lot of these Web 2.0 sites that are looking to be advertising-based as well, because it takes a while to get going on this kind of stuff, and I don't think they realize it.
But when you moved, did you leave a lot of money behind when you went from Federated Media over to Axiom?
Not really. It was more where we really got hit was back in early 2006, where basically we threw off all of our low-dollar ads. We had t-shirt companies and whatnot. And we basically stopped doing those kind of ads, because you can't convince an advertiser that they should be paying, you know, high CPM rates when they can obviously see that you've got garbage ads on your site that definitely didn't pay that much money. So you have to basically run no ads for a little while in order to get people to finally make that jump. And that hurt. The entire year of 2006 was a massive struggle because of that. But at the end, it started paying off. So we made it through, but that was rough.
So you're actually, are you sure that's the case? I mean, when a big brand advertiser looks at the site, they see low CPM type ad running on the site, they will actually say, no, I'm not advertising here.
I was told that was the case. I don't know that for sure.
Right. But anyway, now you're starting to get, I mean, even with a 10 or 20% filling in of your branded advertising, it's starting to work out.
Yeah, because, you know, once you get to our CPM, you don't need a whole lot of sales in order to match your previous revenue level.
Right.
Because it wasn't like at the beginning. See, like, we're in kind of a different spot, like I said, because we're, you know, if you had your own blog, for example, that's getting, you know, 50,000 page views a day or whatever, that's substantial. Probably still not high enough to knock out any mainstream ads.
Right. And what about other places you can run advertising? For example, in sign-up process, putting something like co-registration in there where people get asked, let's say when they sign up, they get asked, are you interested in buying a new car? And
yep.
Their park registration says, are you interested in buying a new car? And then if they say yes, that lead data is then sent to someone and sold for like a dollar or two a lead.
See, that's something we've been really remiss on as well. It's been on our to-do list for quite a while. We got sidetracked with a number of other projects this year. And I suppose it works just because you see newspapers doing this. That was the entire reason they wanted to have you to register on their site for articles in the first place. It was not because they wanted to track you, but it was because they wanted you to fill out those surveys and they could sell that information. I was at a managing editor's conference down in Florida. It was about 4 years ago now, I guess, where somebody actually asked the question, what's the value of the customer that comes and registers so that they can read the articles but click phone contact and any circumstances? And the value is zero, as it turns out. And so that's the reason registrations are at. The reason it's going away now is because sites that did have your registration saw that their traffic numbers dropped, and considering the way everything is going on the internet, if your traffic numbers start dropping and you fall out of the top 10 hunt on, you know, Comscore media metrics, you might as well just go ahead and set fire to the building you work in and walk away and leave and never come back, because you're dead.
So everything depends on what Comscore said, and that's it.
Pretty much, yeah. That's what they do. The internet advertisers pull the top 10 numbers and they go from there, and you can give them all kinds of numbers all day long, but at the end of the day, Comscore look out and they don't really care about anything else. Which is why you're getting interesting things happening. For example, Major League Baseball, MLB.com just filed a cease and desist against Comcast and Nielsen. The numbers were so wrong, they were actually being harmed by them. And I'm watching how this played out because I'm considering doing exactly the same thing because we're in the same boat. If they don't track word numbers, they don't track college numbers, then, you know, that's basically ours, that's 90% of ours as well.
And so maybe this podcast is a better solution where the steps are opened up.
I think so. But again, the problem is that at the end of the day, you can still end up building this stuff. And I think the reason that people like the Comscore and Nielsen is because they spent literally years building arguments saying that their numbers are not only accurate, but impossible to fake. Because you can't fake Comscore traffic. Well, I guess you can do it. There's a couple tricks you can do, but in general, it's pretty difficult to do.
So you're saying there really isn't a good solution to all of this?
No, there actually isn't. And what's funny is because at the end of the day, it's all boiled down to a sales pitch. So, for example, even though our Comscore numbers are abysmal and ridiculous, we're still making sales, and that has to do with sales pitch. I mean, the Comscore number is a slam dunk. If you end up on the top 10 list and you can stay there, then you're fine. You've got nothing to worry about. You'll sell every ad pitch you ever make.
So those guys that are in top 10 on Comscore, they're selling out 100% of their inventory, are they?
They probably are. I don't know that for sure, but it wouldn't surprise me, because that, again, it's no brain thing. If you are a media buyer and you go back to your boss and you're the day and they ask you, where did you buy? Even if they've never heard the site, but they can say, yeah, well, they're ranked 5 on Comscore for, you know, male age 18 to 35. Well, you're not
getting
fucked for that. That's why I like it. It's a no-brainer.
So back to the co-registration lead generation stuff. Let's say I wanted leads from your site, and I was interested in buying a new car from Park, and I came to you and said, hey, Drew, I want to get some of those. How do I get started on a deal with you on something like that?
We currently don't track that information. That's something that we're going to be doing here pretty soon. We have a list of user profile enhancements we want to put out there, and not only, you know, being able to track that, you know, it's also being able to allow people to participate if they want to. And so I would look for that sometime, I don't know, depending on when we can get on it, but sometime maybe like, you know, second quarter 2008.
So right now, there's users don't register. The only place they register for is Total Park. Is that right?
Well, they register for accounts to talk. There's about 370,000 registered accounts right now. But, you know, you have to have an account to make comments, but we don't use anything other than that.
What about at the time when those accounts get started up? Can they say, hey, I want a new car question?
No, and that's only when you're dead.
Right. So can you talk a little bit about, I'll ask you a question and, tell me if I'm out of line. Can you talk about where the revenue comes from on your site? You have Total Park, which is a subscription service. You have CPM advertising through Max, and you have CPM rent inventory through the unknown person that does that. You have Google AdSense, and you also have the Google search bar. Is that correct? Is there anything else that I'm missing?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. And it's also interesting, too, is the Google search revenue, while it was never good, it has been steadily dropping with that end of the Google toolbar and the fact that it's, now that there's a search bar in Microsoft Internet Explorer, it's going down. I mean, it was never a big deal for us anyways, but I don't know if there are any sites that rely on heavily, but if they are, there are, they should probably rethink that.
And you have defaulting to when people type in a search to search the web. Is that because you get paid for AdSense through that, or AdWords?
No, it's because it turns out that's what most people use it for. We tried to set that section down a couple times, and a lot of times we just got bombarded by email. Because people have actually, and this is weird because this is unusual in the sense that most sites this doesn't work. We have a lot of people, an enormous number of people who use Spark as their homepage. When they fire up a browser, it goes to Spark. And they want that search box there so they can treat it like Google rather than starting and having to go straight to Google and typing stuff. It's just for Spark. And because we have that search box on there, then they keep their page on Spark as the homepage. If we remove that, then all of a sudden the usefulness of that stops and our traffic goes down.
That is fascinating. Is that the reason why most sites do it that way, or?
I don't know why most sites do it, because I can't imagine that most sites are a prime startup page destination. I think, for just about anybody else, I don't think I could recommend it, because I don't think anybody would use it, honestly. I mean, people are pretty much used to typing it in browsers or whatnot. We just have a bunch of people that are used to doing it on Spark because they make their homepage. And if you happen to have a site that is a lot of people's homepage, then you want to have it out there, but otherwise you would probably not want to bother at all.
Very cool. All right, and so I guess with the revenue streams, can you talk about like percentages of the numbers they generate? Like,
I don't actually know what they are, but I do know that the total park money is enough where it basically carried it through 2006 when we had no advertising, so that's basically like our baseline keep a weight on money. So the rest of it actually does pretty well. It's just over the top stuff.
Right. Would are we talking like 90% of it come from your CPM advertising?
I don't know. I don't think so. I think it's more than that. I'd have to check the numbers.
Right, but you do have it's pretty much broken down over across the entire site. So you have sort of three or four independent revenue streams.
Yes, that's right. And I mean, that's really generally what you want to do in any business. You want to have as many revenue streams as possible.
Right. And then
even ones that don't pay well.
Right. And then there's obviously one other which we did talk about, and that is the book.
Yes.
And do you want to talk a little bit about the book? I mean, that's obviously a new revenue stream for you and the thinking behind it. And I thought it was very funny. Your style of writing is very unusual, I got to say.
Yeah, people say I write like I talk.
Yeah, I said it's an understatement. So it's like when you're driving talking.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
It's a good read. I mean, so what was the thinking behind the book, and how is that impacting the rest of what you're doing with the site?
Well, the initial concept that the book people wanted me to do is they wanted me to do the funny stories I've ever done on Spark, but I couldn't get excited about that prospect because it just didn't do anything for me. But I thought about media patterns and the ways that I saw this crap news coming into play and how the news uses it and what they use it for and when it comes online and when it doesn't. For example, anytime there's a major news event, all of a sudden the amount of crap news that we can find is on Spark that we're looking for. It drops considerably. Also happens other times of the year. For example, the two worst weeks for garbage news are the week before Labor Day and the week between Christmas and Eve. And the reason for that, interestingly, is because nobody's working. Which is, again, the interesting part about that is that the flow of news goes down when there aren't any journalists around, and you think that would be kind of ass backwards, but it turns out that's the world we live in. So I worked on finding a whole bunch of patterns that in order to try to find all these articles. I came up with a number of them. It's been interesting watching the reaction of journalists who read this because they really are kind of blown away by it because it pretty much nails it. I actually had somebody, there was a gal locally here in Lexington, Kentucky, who works at a local newspaper, who actually in one of her articles went and got excerpts out of her Journalism 101 textbook and put them right up next to the stuff I was saying, and it is not perfectly. The only difference was that I'm swearing a lot more, and I'm questioning why people are doing it, as opposed to the Journalism 101 textbook, which just says do this.
I read the book and came away feeling like I don't understand how I trusted the news at all. It's just...
It's also something everybody, we've all noticed this stuff in the news, but we've never really thought about it that much. I mean, the only reason I have is because I do it all day long. But, once you start paying attention to the patterns, like the media fear monitoring, where they're trying to scare the crap out of you, or seasonal articles that appear at the same time of year, every year, like clockwork, or, talking to, nut jobs that believe in Bigfoot and moon landing and whatnot, or moon landing fake, rather. And, you see all these articles that are basically just out there for sure, and it's interesting because it also allows you to then, one, you can educate yourself and say, okay, this is garbage news, I don't need to pay attention to this as closely as I was. For example, a lot of the stuff that I was saying actually meshed up a lot with my friend Sam Ferriss' book, 4-Hour Work Week. Which he wrote about basically his argument was is that you don't need to watch the news but once a day. I told him probably not, but once a week. Or conversely, I told him, I said, you don't even need to watch the news. Just wait until somebody says, hey, did you hear about such and such? And if it's very interesting, you then go look it up. Don't sit in front of the news and sit there and wait for it to happen, because in reality, there isn't a whole lot of stuff going on that you didn't attend to whatsoever.
So your comment is that you should watch the news like once a week or less?
Yeah, you can totally get away with it. I mean, as far as like what you would need to survive, you probably not even that much. It's really, news is just a different form of entertainment. Masquerading is something that they tell you should actually be doing. It really isn't.
So where, in your opinion, is the most credible news source?
That's a good question. In the States, it's probably a combination of NPR and the Christian Science Monitor. Those guys do a pretty good job. Internationally, the BBC does pretty well, although they're starting to drift a little bit because they've got consultants. They're trying to tell them how to capture the youth market, and unfortunately they're telling them to do things like make the BBC look more like Facebook, make the BBC have comments, which are completely pointless in my opinion, because nobody really has anything interesting to add to conversation other than racist and nasty comments. So it's interesting to see whether or not they'll continue to maintain where they are, but my feeling is they're probably going to start flipping here over time.
And so the book is called It's Not News, It's Fact, How the Hamas Media Tries to Pass Off Crap as News. One of the things I don't actually remember which chapters it was in, unfortunately, but it did help me understand a little bit more about your site and how it's working and just in general how your business works.
Yes.
You also included comments from a lot of your readers in the book. Did that help encourage them to buy the book?
I don't know. That's a good question. I don't know if anybody bought it because it recorded it perfectly because there's no index, so I don't know. Somebody put an index together online. It wasn't me. But I don't know if anybody bought it specifically because of that. The main reason was because I'm not really trying to be serious per se when I make the point about them passing this stuff off. I'm trying to make a point, though, and the best way to do it is you make funny. And a lot of the comments and the examples that we used were absolutely hysterical. For example, there was one in the media fearmongering article we talked about with how Kentucky is spending its homeland security dollars on anything it can because we don't have a lot of homeland security issues being a landlocked state, and I don't know, the teams of terrorists dying around the back of their nose, but so they in order to, you know, keep this money, they have to spend every year, and one year they spend their homeland security money on simulating an attack on a goat fair. And one of the comments that somebody put in there was, he said, I don't know about you guys, but I'll never forget the day that I saw that first goat slam in the World Trade Center. And I thought, you know what, that pretty much set it up right there.
So how does the book fit into your overall strategy? When we talk privately, you talk about things like helping you gain more branding. Can you maybe explain that goal and how that's...
Yeah. One of the things you can do with the book is, I'll just give you a better example that most of your listeners would probably be able to key in better. Look at what Robert Scoble is doing. I mean, basically all he's doing is, he has nothing to talk about. Everything that comes out of his mouth is generally garbage anyways, but he's able to key into the fact that news media will always give you time to talk about a book, no matter what the book is, even if they don't agree with you, because they're set up to do that. And so one of the things that the book allowed me to do is I think I did something like 250 radio interviews in the first 4 days that the book was out, which is more, you know, FaceTime in front of an audience that hasn't necessarily heard about it. You know, then you can also, if you're lucky enough, set yourself up as a media expert on this stuff. And I've actually been called in a couple times for national news shows to discuss. Usually they call it in the media cycle, they call it, has the media gone too far, which is basically the last question anybody asks before they stop talking about something. Anytime you see media covering itself, covering a story, you know they completely run out of stuff. And they've started having me call in and discuss the pattern basically what happened and where they've gone wrong and all that kind of stuff. And again, that's just more promotion. Having my face out in front of people, you know, talking about it. If people like what I have to say, but they've never heard about me or the website, then they'll go check it out and hear it. And so it's basically just more part of the publicity machine, basically.
I remember reading that section in the book about has the media gone too far, and that's the cycle. Yeah. And laughing, seeing that, because it's so right. I never picked that as a pattern before.
Yeah, we all noticed it. I mean, you've heard them talk about it, and usually they'll do it in particularly ridiculous cases. Like, for example, the one I said was when Dick Cheney had this hunting accident job guy. You know, 8 days in, I was sitting in an airport watching CNN wasting the entire morning talking about whether or not the media should be covering this stuff at all as opposed to other stuff. And you'll see them asking this question over and over again. And, you know, as I say in the book, if you have to ask the question, has the media gone too far, and you're the media, then you have gone too far.
And so then it actually gave you a reason to do more public relations.
Yes, exactly. And plus, too, it's like, you know, there's different patents to it. It wasn't the primary motivator, but it's one of those deals where, because it's an available avenue, you take advantage of it. It's also an additional revenue stream. I have stopped writing it. I'm probably going to do another one, that or in the same vein, but something slightly different. And so, you know, just leads on to other things.
And so, do you think, then, that the book is also a big reason why your traffic is up?
It certainly might be. I noticed on Amazon, there's a few reviews posted by people that have never heard of the book before, or heard of the website, rather. And I thought that was interesting, because that was actually the whole point of doing it, is to try to capture an audience of people that don't have heard of ARC, which I think right now Maxim's just off the cuff estimate. They think about 2 out of 10 of all people in the United States have heard of ARC, which is good. I mean, that's absolutely fantastic, but it needs to be 8, not 2.
Yeah, right. Do you have any sales numbers for the book? I think you mentioned it's been selling well.
Yeah, 25,000 copies in the first 12 weeks, which I thought sucked, but they told me it was actually put in the top 1% of all books sold this year so far. So I guess book sales are moving a lot lower than we all think they do.
With your branding strategy, I mean, a Maxim carrying the book into meetings when they're going to sell guys, or how's that?
Yes, as a matter of fact, that's exactly what happened. We got a box of 100 books, and anytime we could call out in sales, we always take a couple and drop them off. It's very similar to what people do with, you know, brochures or, you know, dossiers or, you know, whatever. I mean, people have got all this little material. You want to have, it's the same concept behind having your logo printed on a pen that you leave in somebody's office. They set to market, it's in the entire book.
Cool. All right, well, that's everything that I can think of to ask you. Is there anything you want to talk about that we haven't covered?
Well, I think so. I think we pretty much hit everything. If something occurs to me, I'll be sure to let you know.
Cool. Well, Drew, thanks so much for your time.
No problem. Thank you.